PHP Radio
on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network,
your number one source for all things golf.
Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.
Hello, you golfing legends, and welcome back to another episode of the original Off Course. I'm your host, Dan Edwards, and joining me this week is a very popular man over there at Mizuno Golf. His name is Chris Fauchal. We all love him. Try and hype him up as much as we can before he gets a chance to talk. Huge piece of the conversation over there. And anyways, Chris, welcome back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. This is always fun. And for once, I'm not doing it in my basement. I'm actually like in my office now hanging out. So what's going on?
Well, I'll tell you what's going on. As I'm introing, my dog's in the corner of the room having a dream and doing that like, like, I love dude, settle down. So perfect way to get started in the episode. How's the year going, man?
Man, the year's been fantastic. You know, I feel like this is, when you look at the years on the calendar and everything and what's going to be a big year, what's going to do great for us, we've had so many cool things to talk about this year just at Mizuno. You know, we had the Mizuno Pro launch that came this spring. So that was all of the 241, 243, 245, the fly high. They crushed it. We did the blue finish of the T24 wedge. We had our ST Max come. We dropped some Azalea irons, which were, I think, a couple people noticed were pretty sweet. And now we're towards the end of the year, and we already have some more new stuff coming. So we're starting to tease some new JPXs, which you may or may not have seen. But we got a lot of cool stuff going on, and I feel like business is just flying for us. And it's like we cannot build clubs fast enough, which is, it's a good problem and a bad problem, but business-wise, things are awesome. And at home, I got a new little daughter at home as well. So it came right at the start of the year. So I'm trying to remember when we talked last, but my family continues to grow and we're doing great.
Yeah. So that's number two for you, right?
That's number two. Yeah. My son turns three on Monday. And then my daughter is almost eight months now, which is crazy.
So what you're saying is you're a terrible golfer now.
it's funny you say that. Like, I'd been playing so bad, and I was looking at like my handicap index. You know, you can sort it by year, what are your average rounds, all this stuff. I'd been playing really bad. I'd been on a bad stretch since Noah was born. I hate to say that. Like, hadn't played great, handicap had gotten up, and I've shot under par two out of my last three rounds. So I'm actually like round in a corner, starting to play well. My bag right now, I put 2 4-3s in and am absolutely loving them right now. So to me, I feel like my game is in surprisingly good shape considering how little I'm playing.
A little bit of Victory Cup fanfare there, or warfare there, a little mind games going on here, or what?
I'm so excited right now. I was talking to Walker, who will be there. Walker, he's sitting literally right on the other side of this wall, and he might have some cool stuff to preview there to show off, but he's trying to get his game together. My game's coming into shape, and I played with John a couple times recently too. He's ready to go. It's going to be a really fun event, and I cannot wait for it.
That's awesome. Very interesting year so far, and I think throughout the industry we're seeing a lot of really cool concepts coming out. Companies taking risks or new ideas that they're incorporating into their product. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a weird way to start this episode. When I think about Mizuno, I have like certain stages that I focus on in my life. I remember getting some of my irons back in the day, thinking they were just the greatest things, and finding out all these new materials that are going into them. Very impactful with the Mizuno MP32s, which, you know, molded my game for quite a while. But I think when it comes to the technology side of Mizuno, that sort of not so much player forward, but tech forward iron concepts, I always anchor it to that conversation we had down in Atlanta a couple years ago when we were hitting JPX for the first time, and I was falling in love with Chromoly for the very enjoyable range session where I tried to do damage to a camera and kept missing it. But long story short, I like that companies have this sort of staying power in material or in design that allows you to anchor your perspective back to what it was like then, and, you know, accept and hope that the concepts remain the same, but the technology continues to advance potential for each iron. So I know that's a really long-winded way of asking you about this, But I mean, that's a couple iterations ago of JPX, and now that we have this new concept out today, number one, how much do you think you guys have moved forward in that? And then number two, is that part of like that whole Chromoly starting point? Is that where you really see this JPX story really increasing and catapulting into what it is today?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, where hot metal started and where it is today is two like very different animals. But to your point, all based around the same kind of concept. And I'll even like go back a step further than that, even and just talk about JPX as a whole. Like really what you started to see happen from Mizuno when JPX came versus our MX line of the past is JPX had so much of a focus on the technology of COR and ball speed, consistent ball speeds, elevated ball speeds, higher launch, all the things that come with the distance aspect of club engineering. And that's kind of where JPX 800 was the start of that. You know, before that, when you're talking MXs, we had MX 23s, 25s, we still had a lot of forgings. We even had MX 100, 1000, like lots of different things. But the idea wasn't really bringing as much like driver COR design into it. And with MX 800, it kind of started there. So from there, we were trying to engineer high COR into irons, but it was working and we did a lot of really cool things with the 800, 825, 850. But when we introduced Chromoly with the JPX 900, that was a game changer for us. So that material itself, it has such unique properties in terms of the ability or what we do to it is the way we heat treat it in certain areas and not heat treat it in other areas allow us to recognize some really cool strength benefits on perhaps, you know, for example, the face, the sole, stuff like that, while still leaving some malleability and bendability in the hosel. So it's combining all those things of how do I make this thing as hot and strong as possible, but still be super custom fittable. And that's kind of where Chromoly started the things for the JPX family and the hot metal family. But you've seen that family grow. And again, it all goes to the fact that I'm saying we want to generate distance, but we want to do it in a custom fittable manner. So when we first launched Hot Metal, it was one model. There was the JPX 900 Hot Metal. The 919, we had the Hot Metal. Then we added the Hot Metal Pro. And then since then, we've added the Hot Metal High Launch. Again, all these things adding to the custom fittability of each one. And the Chromoly materials continue to advance from there. We started with one version of Chromoly. Now we're using a nickel Chromoly that just takes those benefits I was talking about to the next level. So yeah, it's really been an evolution of what can we do to make a golf club super hot, super easy to launch, but ultimately super easy to get dialed into you, like dialed into your specs, your fitting, if you need a combo set, your eye even, your sole thickness demands, your top line thickness demands, all those things. And that's where this newest iteration, three versions of the 925 Hot Metal Pro with nickel Chromoly, just take it to the next level.
I want to step back from that really quickly to ask about the overall iron lineup. You know, Mizuno Pro, I've always seen it, and maybe it's because I've played to like a round scratch for so many years now, fortunately, that I tend to look at that lineup first and really focus on it. You know, there's a reason why I assume you call it the pro lineup, that the intent mm-hmm. is for the more refined golf swings, that's where you should focus on. But when there's a very subtle overlap on the JPX, you have the tour, you had the Forge. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's going to be a continuation. I would hope and assume, but as you smile at me, but you know, there's a willingness to overlap there, but there's also a very clear segment between the two lineups. And right. You know, I guess my first question to that would be, how much does the performance impact both of those and the quality of design allow you to have more freedom between the two lines?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say with Mizuno, the the quality of the design and kind of the execution is the biggest difference between them. We want the quality exists in both of them. You know, we don't skip steps in JPX that we do in MP or MP that do other things we do in JPX. Like, to me, with Mizuno, there's the quality is guaranteed in that. To me, the biggest difference in there is just it's an aesthetic execution as well as I'd say almost how far are we willing to take things is a kind of a line in the sand between Mizuno Pro and JPX. So you see a lot of our new technologies really originate in JPX. Chromoly is a perfect example of that, where Chromoly first showed up in the JPX 900 hot metal. Now you see it in a forged Chromoly in the JPX Forge. You see a Chromoly face and neck that's forged into the 245. You see a Chromoly long irons in the 243s. So you're starting to see like technologies and advancements start in JPX. And as they get further refined, kind of work their way into the Mizuno Pro world. And I'd say what that world is composed of, it's just cleaner executions of high-tech products. So, you know, we have literally, like I joke about it, we have a design philosophy book around Mizuno Pro. It's kind of a cool little thing that talks about what we will and won't do in a Mizuno Pro. And it speaks a lot to the aesthetics, the feels, the color usage, the simplicity of the design, like, or I should say the aggressiveness of the design. But like, honestly, to the point of like how many like major lines move from the toe to heel direction. Like, we don't want it to be so aggressive or we've got lines everywhere and stuff like that. You don't see that in Mizuno Pro. So it's an aesthetic execution based off around like just the old school club engineering, but technology has worked its way into it that originates in that JPX side of things.
I like that it's almost like there are two tires rotating at two different speeds when it's Mizuno Pro to JPX. Mm-hmm. Like, there, what I've always appreciated about Mizuno is there's a very clear design argument that is steeped in tradition, I think, that mm-hmm. that goes into that pro lineup, and the willingness to take a chance is really, in my perspective, only done in something that has been vetted pretty aggressively elsewhere mm-hmm. with pro. And then you go to JPX and I'm not saying you guys are, you know, all cards are on the table kind of thing,
right?
But there seems to be a lot more freedom there to experiment or take a chance on a new technology or, you know, try something that maybe isn't familiar to fans of Mizuno before. And then that eventually potentially bleeds into the pro lineup. Is that pretty fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say. You know, it's almost like there's so much tradition around Mizuno Pro that you can't push it too far. Like, you almost have to check a bunch of boxes before you can try something on Mizuno Pro side. Like, even like something, this is going to sound silly to, you know, someone who is like, oh, you're really overthinking things. But I think there's a lot that goes into it, where even like hollow body construction, which has become such a popular way to make a golf club. We've been doing hollow body construction in MP and back into MX before that, but our executions were different. Like, hollow body isn't always hollow body. Like, our MX 1000 back in the day was a hollow body design. It was a carpenter steel face with a cast back piece, tungsten on the inside. And then we had a hollow body with the MPH4, the MPH5, where we were using forged face and neck. So even like a high tech construction has that element of old school, I'd call it old school craftsmanship with the forging of the face and neck and stuff like that. So we bring in a lot of old school elements to new high tech things. And that's where you're right. There's a lot of vetting that goes on. Like, we're not just going to say, what's the most aggressive material we can use? Like, just throw it in a Mizuno Pro. Like, that's never going to happen. You're not going to see that happen.
Well, I think part of that supports the idea that someone who's played an MP in the past can comfortably move forward. And mm-hmm. you know, I'll tell you, I've got a buddy who I play with every weekend who is obsessed with your products. Okay. Like, he rolls an Omoe putter, thinks it's the greatest thing on the planet Earth, even if he switches his grip once in a while to accommodate it. He's got an older set of Mizuno MP series irons. And I've been heckled. I'm like, you say these things are so good, but you won't upgrade to the better product. So, you know, but it's funny because when he hit my, I've got the 2.21s from the last iteration, and he was really impressed with them. And I'm sure if he goes and hits 2.41, he'll be just as impressed. But my joke there is that most of the time when you have a player like that, it's one of, they either love their current irons, which is his problem, or if they do make that switch, they're afraid of significant change to that overall feedback. And I get a sense that you you take that very seriously, I think, in both lineups, but more so in MP. And I want to challenge that really quick. You had talked about making careful considerations and maintaining where MP stands. I believe the last iteration between 2.21 or the 2.2 and the 2.4 series, you actually refine those lines a little bit more and tighten them up. Was that a goal to get back to a little bit more of that traditional profile, or is that just a happenstance on design?
Yeah, they did get, I'd say, you know, when Mizuno is doing their best, I think when Mizuno is speaking to what those Mizuno Pro players are looking for is when we're getting kind of smaller and tighter and kind of refining the lines and the shapes. And to me, the ultimate sign of a well-engineered product is you're getting more performance out of it than you think you will or think you should be able to. So when you look at like the, you know, the 2.41 versus 2.21, it did get a little bit smaller, more compact, a little bit tighter, tighter sole, thinner top line, a little bit less offset, just cleaner package. Again, this is a muscle back. It's a one piece grain flip forward. like we're not reinventing the wheel with this one. We're just making subtle refinements to make sure that you're getting very consistent performance out of it and speaking more to that like modern, better player as well. But then when you take your next step to like the 2.23 versus 2.43, they utilize a very similar construction to them. But the 2.43 goes a little bit further, launches a little bit higher, and it's smaller and thinner and feels better. Like it's all those things of like, it, the easy way to make it do those things would have been to make it just a touch larger. Like that's almost like the, I'd call it the training wheels of club engineering, is if you make a club like X amount bigger, it'll be that much better numbers wise in like perform, not necessarily performance, I will say performance-wise. I'd say mass properties-wise, you take the same thing and just make it a little bit bigger. Your trampoline got larger. Your COR is going to elevate a little bit. Your center of gravity got a little bit further away, so the club is a little bit more stable. CG gets a little bit deeper. Like, it does all the things you need other than the eye test. So to me, that's where it's like to not fall into the trap of just making it bigger for bigger sake and to say it's more forgiving because we made it bigger. If we can do it the other way and refine the lines and make a better player who didn't necessarily love the 2.23 all of a sudden look at the 2.43 because it looks smaller and then be like, oh wow, that thing did something I didn't expect. That's when you're doing something. And to me, like, I'll just speak personally as a player, like, I've got, it's fun if you can see behind me, like in this bag right here is every Mizuno 6 iron I've played. So I've got, and you go through the list of them. It's like, I was always a shallow cavity player. I've never really been a muscle back guy. Like, I've always loved just a small shallow cavity back. So with the 2.23, I was so excited for that golf club because it's the small shallow cavity back. Plus it's got a little bit more kick to it with the chromoly material. But it never quite fit my eye. It always looked a little bit long from heel to toe, a little thick on the top line, to the point that I actually went and played the 2.45s over the 2.25s over the 2.23s because they looked a little bit more compact to me. Fast forward a couple of years, the 2.4 series, it's even better. Like, to me, it goes as far as the 2.25 did, but looks smaller than the 2.23 did. So it's like, it's the perfect answer to all of those things I was looking for.
That's awesome. I love the rundown. And I know we've talked Mizuno Pro in the past on the show. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea of drawing comparisons to the two lines is a pretty critical piece before we really kick off the JPX conversation.
Sure.
And I also want to blame you. Like, I've got a THP shirt on. You have a Mizuno Pro shirt on. So you're like forcing me into looking at the idea of talking about some of the irons I love the most on the planet. So that's your fault. But you know, let's talk 925 because it's a very exciting release. You know, we had a chance to talk through it a little bit previously, and I got to hear some of the new concepts that are in it. Now that it's out there, we've had a big discussion on THP already. Everyone's getting a chance to look at it and read the feedback we provided on our homepage. What is the early response? I mean, I'm sure you've had it in fitters' hands, and what's it look like?
It's funny. Everybody who has hit it is absolutely loving it. And you're starting to see, you go through a bunch of the reviews and stuff, and it's, again, people being shocked at like just how forgiving it is. And I always laugh because the embargo on it was the 19th. So starting at the morning of the 19th, I'm reading comments everywhere. Like, it photographs clunky because it got thicker. Like, what got thicker is the actual look of the blade from the back, because the badge and how it's filled in and how the actual cavity is shaped, it looks a little bit thicker. But in actuality, it got significantly thinner. It got hotter. It got faster. It got more stable. So I think there's a big disconnect between a first look and an in-hand first look. So it's funny, to the point where even when we were showing it to some accounts, like, you know, I've been for the last month or two, I've been doing the rounds of meeting kind of some of the key buyers in certain areas, meeting some key fitters and stuff like that. I always make it a point to, when I show your first image, I hand it to you at the same time, because I want you to not judge by one thing or the other, because people instantly are looking for what's wrong in a photo. And when you hand someone a golf club, the first thing they do is look at it address.
Yeah.
And oh, once you see it at address, oh, okay, now I understand what this is. Now, oh, wow, you did this on the back too? Like, you become more open to the back shape once you recognize that we didn't screw up the front. Like, it looks, or at address, it looks fantastic. So the initial reaction has been really, really good. The feel is great. The distance is phenomenal. And I always like to joke, you know, this is our first time using multi-material in our hot metal family. So you have some tungsten in there, which we've never done. And the fact that we've been able to outperform this number of golf clubs that we've outperformed, and the market shares that we've done, and the number of fitters who trust us, in what we've executed in a one-piece construction, now that we're able to kind of take that handcuff off and engineer it with some multi-material, like, this is just setting the path for us to really, really excel for what hot metal is and will become in the future.
You know, I'm always entertained at the stock photos that show up and how quickly people make an opinion or draw conclusions based purely on that, when reality, there's only two places I ever look at a golf club. It's in the bag,
right,
and at address. And everything else just doesn't matter. I'm the kind of guy where if you continue to refine that top line, like, I don't care how broad it is at address. I remember when as I go back to your shirt again, I remember when 225s came out, I was blown away from the presentation, and they aren't a small sole. By comparison to, let's say, 221. So, you know, the idea that I can look down at something and not be like appalled by it is such an important piece of the puzzle. So, you know, I think it's interesting how quickly people react to just that singular image and make so many judgments, knowing fully well that a lot went into it. Like, you can't see that there's like internal ribbing structures at the top of the iron head. You can't see what that material is doing in the badging. You can't see the face technology that's been incorporated. But, and yet, you know, we've all made our decision before we even go hit it. So it's funny, man. Go ahead.
Yeah, I always talk like Mizuno people are like the hipsters of the golf community, in that like, we like how it used to be. Oh, we knew about this back in the day. And it's like, oh, we don't want the new stuff until you see and hit the new stuff. Like, it's so funny how the instant reaction to almost any golf club we point out is, oh, wait, you changed something? Like, how dare you? Like, so it's always cracks me up. But I think, to me, the thing with Mizuno is like, hopefully we've established a level of trust and confidence in what we're doing, and the performance, the feel, the looks, the aesthetics, all of those things. Again, like, you've been staring at my mug for a long time talking about Mizuno products. I hope you trust me a little bit. I'm not going to let this get screwed up. I'm not going to let this go off the rails. So these clubs are awesome.
to get a better visual on that, do you get the same sort of feedback from people on other products in your line, or is it predominantly irons? And I want to lead you in by saying that I think there's a pretty solid percentage of people out there when they say, what do you think about when you say the name Mizuno? They have a very isolated perspective on a very high quality iron company.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I think people are more open and more like, the further you get away from that one piece forged iron is the more people will kind of question what you're doing and kind of ask and act a little odd. Like, it's been interesting, like our wedges, people seem very open and receptive to trying our wedges. Again, with our wedges, the second we do something a little bit more, call it not MPs, when we start to get questioned, that's where like the blue wedge was so funny, because at first people hated it until you see it and you're like, wow, that frames it nicely. It looks really like it actually works. So people question things a lot in terms of what they do. And I think everybody wants us to be just that old school traditional company. But if you look at the history of us, we are a tech company. Like, we put a lot of high tech engineering, and honestly, it's a lot of strong controls over manufacturing processes. I'd say that's like our biggest strength, is understanding the manufacturability of different things. And that goes into, how can you forge a golf club? What can you do in the forging process to take advantage of a forging, but also push the envelope of what a forging is? You see, with chromoly material as well, how can we take a material that has been used in the industry before, but has never been used like we use it? It's never been used with these specific heat treatments, with these multi-piece slide core designs, stuff like that. Like, it's been used as a face material for somebody else because it's strong. But we've used it as a club to make a one-piece cast body out of, that's a really high-tech cast body that all of a sudden, by localization of heat, we can then bend it a certain way that you couldn't before. So to me, it's like, we are a really techie company that just happens to have a lot of people who are picky about good looking clubs too. So I think everybody sticks around here for a long time. Like, you look around these offices that I'm in, like the tenure of employees, especially on the engineering side and everything, is so long. Like, we know head shapes, and we're so particular in head shapes. And it's funny. It's like, I joke about myself where, you know, obviously I'm a head shape snob. Big time. Like, I know what looks good at a dress. And to me, that goes across kind of categories. I never thought I was, until it kind of hit me at one point. Like, my first introduction to Mizuno was, I played Tezoid True Irons back in the day. Like, that was the first set of blades I ever bought. And it was before I worked for Mizuno. It was when I was in high school I bought them. But for some reason, I was like, I don't like this pitching wedge. And like, I got rid of the pitching wedge and I had a different pitching wedge. I look at it now and I realize what I didn't like. I didn't like the head shape of it. Like, at the time, I didn't realize it was just something I didn't like. So it's funny how ingrained, it almost feels like it's in my blood, and all the Mizuno employees' bloods, what a golf club can be. So to me, all that to circle around to say, trust us what we're doing, and trust the looks and trust the processes. And that goes beyond just the irons. Like, our woods are phenomenal right now. Like, those who haven't tested them, go out and give them a try. The head shapes are great. The sounds are great. I was talking just recently to a longtime employee of one of our biggest competitors who said he was out looking for drivers, and the only one whose head shape he liked was ours. So he's now playing Mizuno woods, which I thought
really
was hilarious. So it's really interesting, kind of, the DNA of what makes a beautiful, good sounding, good feeling golf club, combined with our manufacturing like expertise, is what's allowed us to be what we are. So that's where I want people to look at us beyond just forged irons, because we have advanced a lot of different processes, a lot of different categories, well beyond where they had been. And well, I don't even know if I answered your question.
I think we got out of what we needed. So that was beautiful. But we should probably dive into JPX a bit more on a design philosophy. I know there are lots of people out there who have played the past series, and are probably really protective of the potential that, that they've had, the success they've had with them, and are looking to upgrade. So I want to start by asking, what is the biggest storyline going into 925?
Yeah, I'd say that there's two big storylines going into it. First is the second generation of using our nickel chromoly material. To say the big story is that we're doing it again sounds kind of like a thing you shouldn't say. But again, talking about manufacturing processes, now that we have a little bit more experience under our belt, like to me, the second iteration of a material is when we really kind of accelerate with it because we understand that material a little bit better. So with the nickel chromoly in its second iteration, that we've really fine-tuned and changed up the what we're calling our contour face, our contour lips face. And that's the actual like the multi-thickness profile of that face. It used to be I call it thick in the middle, and then it kind of connected down to the sole to help reinforce it there. Now it's a totally rethought version of that. It's an elliptical shape that slants from kind of low heel to high toe that goes down to only 1.2 millimeters thickness. 1.2 millimeters on a one-piece golf club from a single material like that doesn't have foam underneath it or something to stop it from flexing is almost unheard of in the industry. It is so thin. Anyone else that I can think of that goes that thin literally has some sort of foam or material behind it that essentially stops it from flexing so much. Ours, we literally create a 1.2 millimeter perimeter around the contour ellipse face that allows that almost act as like the center of percussion to allow the entire face to flex more uniformly. So you're going to get greater ball speed, but more than anything, more consistent ball speed. So with these, like we didn't jack the lofts crazy strong. They're a half degree stronger in the scoring irons than the predecessor, but you are going to see longer distance because the COR got higher and the core area got higher. On top of that, to me, I'd say that story number, if that's story number one, story number two is the use of the tungsten and how we've done that, where we've been utilizing, I'd call it a more toe-weighted design to increase the moment of inertia over the past couple generations. Now, by utilizing a denser material like tungsten and focusing that low and forward, we're able to reduce the amount of toe weight without sacrificing moment of inertia. So it still is equally as forgiving, but it's easier to control. The head's not in as much control because the CG to shaft axis isn't as long because it's not as toe weighted. So it's an easier club to control, but that tungsten weight allows us to do that. And also, again, you focus that mass down low, it helps that thing get up in the air. So when you're combining that high launch and that extreme ball speed, it's a club that is explosive. And between the Hot Metal Pro and the High Launch, there's one that a lot of different players could try. It touches a lot of different fitters and a lot of different needs. The High Launch being that slower swing speed player who wants just even a little bit more help from loft. And then the Hot Metal and the Hot Metal Pro are both on the stronger side, but the Pro is that thinner profile version, thinner sole, thinner top line, less offset.
So you talked a lot about big time ball speed, hot face, you know, lots of distance on these. I look back to, and thank God, I think we're finally past that stage of golf design. But I look back to 10, 15 years ago, and the kind of irons that people talked about like that, one of them, let's say a six iron would go 185 and the next one would go 225.
Right.
You know, catching these crazy flyers. So, you know, as much as I think it's important to talk about the performance benefits of an iron like this, I'm really curious about that face design. Does that really support and benefit those who hit all around the face to create a similar distance number when they miss the perfect shot?
Totally. And just go back to what you're saying, like the two things of when people were first chasing COR, it's chasing a peak COR is what was happening. You know, now that we've kind of reached a peak COR, now it's about how do you get that peak COR to stay as consistent as possible? You know, we make charts and graphs of where, you know, at this many millimeters from the sweet spot, the COR is here. Then, you know, typically you'd see it go up and you'd that typical bell curve shape. And that bell curve used to be very, very steep. we keep flattening that bell curve, not because we're lowering the peak, but because we're raising the outer portions. So that COR is getting more consistent. So you're not getting as many, like, you know, you're not seeing hot spots. You're seeing the whole face hot as opposed to just part of the face hot. And a lot of that also comes from the fact that it is a one piece construction aside from the tungsten, which is pushed low in the front. You know, we don't have a welded face insert. When you have a welded face insert, all of a sudden you have areas that have to be reinforced and they are thicker. So it starts to make that curve go from flat to like this. So that leads itself to kind of hot spots and dead spots. Ours, we're engaging that entire head in the impact so that regardless of impact location, you're getting really consistent speeds. On top of that, it's funny, the word you mentioned was flyers. So a part of why it seemed like flyers is a lot of what happened too is because as that peak COR was getting so high, ultimately you started to see spin get so low, it's uncontrollable. And when spin is at like a threshold level where, yeah, it's staying in the air, but once it drops a little bit below that, all of a sudden it's just gone. Like it's not a controllable distance. And you start to see clubs that, you know, on the iron side where you're trying to fly at a specific distance, it flies that distance and then it rolls way past that. You know, another thing that we always focus on is how do we make sure you're not living on a razor's edge in terms of being too low a spin. We need that spin level to be in a mid zone as opposed to the lower end of that mid zone, because then you get away with more consistency of a slightly high on the face, low on the face impact that will naturally, just by physics, it will vary the spin rate. So if you're living at a zone where a perfect shot is right at the borderline acceptable number, then a perfect shot goes one distance. But if that spin rate drops, all of a sudden you're in trouble. Or if the spin rate climbs, you're in trouble. We don't want to live there. We want to live in that mid spin zone. So that's kind of another part of the focus on it. And ultimately what that leads to is just more consistent distance. Distance is great, but if you don't know what distance is going, that's not great. So we're all about making that as consistent as and predictable as possible.
You know, one of the things I've always wondered about when it comes to irons that are built for distance or built for forgiveness is how you measure the finalized goal when you're creating these and putting them into your systems. A lot of people ask about, well, they went really strong on this loft. And what I think people don't recognize is if the technology doesn't support the strength of loft, then you're just going to have a ball that goes super low and falls out of the sky, and it's not going to be, right, you know, performing the way you want it to. And I've always understood that you create this iron with certain weights in certain locations to promote launch, but by doing that, you require a little bit of more aggressive lofting to get into a certain loft window that you desire your players to hit into. Is that a primary point of conversation?
I'd say it's a point of conversation the OEMs have kind of pushed a little bit. So there's some truth to it, but at the same time, they're, you know, to say loft jacking is, I only made it stronger because otherwise it would go too high, I think is a bit of a marketing spin to things.
Okay.
So I think there is truth that, you know, if you had a hot metal construction on a 241 chassis, like a 241 loft, 34 degree 7 iron with, you know, ultra thin face or whatever, for a better player or for a faster swing speed player, it would go crazy high. Like there is truth to that. So you do want to start strengthening it. But we've gotten to a point where I wouldn't say that lofts are weak enough that a change in the geometry is going to dictate us going even stronger. Right now, I think it's more at a point of it's an arms race between the OEMs in terms of what the lofts are going to be. I hate to say that. There's a lot of truth to it, though, because, you know, you go into a fitting cart and you're going, I'm going to test this TaylorMade, this Callaway, this Titleist, this Cobra, this Mizuno, this Ping. I'll test all these 7 irons. If the Mizuno is 3 degrees weaker, I hate to say, even though it's not necessarily going to win on those launch monitor fittings. So I hate that we've all been forced to kind of play a little bit of a loft jacking game. And now it's who can generate the best results of those stronger lofts. And that's why you see us resist the urge to really strengthen much. We went a half degree stronger only on the scoring irons. Again, that's to help bridge the gap between each club, make sure you're not having, you know, big spaces between your 7 and your 8 or your 8 and your 9. So that we're bridging those to make sure that they all kind of flow nicely as a set. But at the same time, we did increase the ball speed. We increased the launch. So you should get more, you should see and recognize more distance benefit than just that half degree of loft. You'll get more out of it than that. But again, like if it were up to me, I think clubs are still a little bit on the too strong side, but it's a kind of part of the game you have to play a little bit, which I hate to say it as someone sitting in literally this seat at a club OEM, but there's truth to that.
Interesting. That was an incredibly honest response that I don't think anyone was expecting, but I think it's good, man. I think there's a level of reality there, and unfortunately a bunch of loft truthers out there are just going to have an unbelievable time engaging with that if they choose to listen. But you know, I think it also, it represents the validation for having a product like HL in the line. There's an understanding that, and people say this, I can't launch the ball, I can't spin the ball. You put a product like that out there and suddenly it's more in their realm. So is that a big part of why HL came to be? Is it out of necessity or is it out of styling?
It's absolutely out of necessity. You know, we did a huge study around our shaft optimizer of something that we've developed, and it's actually ingrained in like, or built into our shaft optimizer software called the Threshold Loft. The concept being that everybody at every swing type, at every swing speed, and their given swing DNA being your angle of attack, your your static loft or dynamic loft, I should say, has a loft that they can carry and a loft that they cannot carry. A part where all of a sudden it's like, I just fell off the cliff, I can't hit this anymore. What is that threshold for a given player? So as the clubs get stronger and stronger, like, it's great as an OEM to say, we made this thing so great that we were able to jack the lofts 3 more degrees. Ultimately, loft is king. It really is. Everything else is, what can we do within those loft barriers? Like, what can we do to a club at that loft? So if that weren't the case, then all these clubs that kept getting stronger would still have 3 irons, would still have 2 irons. Like, your 3 iron would be at 16 degrees and I'd hit it, 275 yards. But that's not the case, because you hit a threshold where loft takes over and loft controls everything. And ultimately, that's where hot metal high launch came from, is that, you know, say we're at 27 degrees on a 7 iron. You start to see, if your head speed is below, or I'd say your club speed is below on a 7 iron, like 84, 85 miles an hour, it's maybe even a little bit lower than that, but your dynamic loft, you know, your shaft lean is forward, so you're de-lofting it more from there. Ultimately, it's like, can I handle 27 degrees? Some players can, some players can't. Speed helps. Dynamic loft helps, angle of attack, all those things can help or hurt you. So given your swing DNA, we want to be able to measure and recommend, can you handle a given loft? And that's what that threshold loft is. So ultimately, we've developed high launch because we found that it was almost 40% of players who swung our shaft optimizer should not be playing as strong a loft as lives in our hot metal and our hot metal high launch. They should be playing other stuff. You know, I'd argue that for a player who's on the slower swing speed side, the hot metal club is harder to hit than our 2-4-1, because the 2-4-1 actually has enough loft to get in the air. Like, if you were to hit a 7 iron of each one, you'd probably hit the 7 iron of the 2-4-1 muscle back better and more consistent than you would the 7 iron of the high of the hot metal, and which sounds so counterintuitive, but that's just how, that's the power of loft. That's how strong loft is and how much loft dictates so much of what happens in the golf swing. So that's where it all kind of came from. So that's kind of why we have multiple specs within it and why the ability to bend a club is so important too. You know, you could be right where your threshold loft is half a degree less than is on the 5 iron of the hot metal. Rather than go all the way to a high launch, which is a couple, 3 degrees weaker, you could out request that hot metal bent a half degree week, and all of a sudden you're living within your threshold loft. So all these special things in the fitting world tie into, do I get the most out of my equipment? Do I get the most out of the technology built into them?
How are you on time, Chris? You got five more minutes, so you
got
to wrap.
I got five more minutes. Let's
okay.
go. Yes.
Cool. So I think one of the questions, one of the things that I've experienced is there OEMs are either engaging in technology when it comes to fittings and when it comes to data collection, or they're not. And I think those who aren't are falling way behind the curve. It sounds like the Mizuno Optimizer, which has been around for a long time, has really allowed you to support golfers at another level. Do you find that to be the case, where it's really allowing the design team to get engaged with your target audience?
For sure. I mean, honestly, while there were some really cool innovations, like tech-wise and, you know, consumer forward, in our movement from our Shaft Optimizer 2 to our Shaft Optimizer 3D, to me, the biggest thing is what it's going to result in the future. And that's the 3D version of it. It has a Bluetooth software that helps connect and record data, like honestly, like big data. Like, we're recording 40 data points of every golf swing that a player's taking. Even though we're reporting to you your specific swing DNA, we'll report to you your head speed, your kick angle, your release factor, shaft lean. We'll report like just a handful of them. In the background, we're collecting so much more that we're using to analyze how can we help engineer clubs better and how can we help put sets together better and stuff like that. So yeah, to me, if you're not looking at that data and understanding what's working and what's not working, then it's like you're engineering in a vacuum. It's not real world, and you will get left behind by those who are engineering based off of real world findings and real world trends. Because it's amazing how you start to see trends over years of, you know, angle of attack getting steeper, head speeds doing one thing or another, or something like that. So ultimately, we're designing everything based off of what we're learning with that.
You know what I'm excited about is when something like Optimizer is going to allow you to market and say, look, we are past this point. This is what will perform for you. Stop worrying about the information that exists on the internet, or stop worrying about the finalized distance in a fitting bay. Let's focus on what's best possible for you and then go for that.
Absolutely. And that's why, to me, like, the term swing DNA is so valuable, because this is you. This is what Dan Edwards does. This is what Chris Fauchel does. Like, I could care less about a big review or the robot said this and blah, blah, blah. If I can understand what you do, how you deliver a club, how dynamically that club acts when you swing it, then we can engineer something that will be fit for you, not just in the 7-iron, but then how does that 7-iron react to the 8-iron, to the 7, to the 9-iron, to the wedge, and going up in the club, up in the bag, and how does everything work together, even down to the point of given a given loft and given a technology, we can very accurately predict what your launch parameters will be. We could say, you need this type of ball. You need a ball with this many pieces. It's going to launch at this level. It's going to do this. Like, it speaks to everything that you do to make you a better golfer. So if you don't understand what you're doing and you're just reading what others are doing, you're missing out.
Two more quick questions. How's the sound, first of all?
The sound of the hot metal?
Yes.
It's awesome. It's really like, and to me, the scary thing when you're engineering a club that gets down to 1.2 millimeters is, how's it going to sound? Like, you know, with Mizuno, you don't want it to sound clacky. And a lot of like the high COR golf clubs have a crack to them that isn't the most pleasing thing. We really engineer the sound of this a lot. And that's where you'll see the sound rib that runs across the back, as well as when you look underneath the top line, you'll see some reinforcing ribs across there. All those things to help us make sure that not only is it going to sound, it does sound hotter. Like, it doesn't sound like a 241. It definitely sounds hotter, but it is a soft hot. Like, it is a really good feel.
Soft hot, I like that. last question. I don't see Forge and I don't see Tour in line yet. Is that to be determined? Is that to be coming? What are you willing to release on that one?
So what I'll say on that is, if you look at our history with 923, you did not see Tour Forge when we first launched them either. If you do some scouring on certain conformance lists, you may see some things that may or may not exist in certain areas. But I'll say you haven't seen it all. And there are going to be some tweaks and some things that are unexpected and I'd say unpredicted from a routinely predictable company. Like 923 replaced with 925. I don't think we shocked the world with anybody there, but I think what the versions of those clubs you're talking about will be shocking once you see them. Hold tight for those, but for right now, go hit your hot metals.
Wicked, yeah. I mean, Hot Metal Pro is an insane experience every time I hit it, so totally worth that. Chris, any final thoughts today or last little tidbits on 925 for everyone?
No, I want everyone to go out and hit them, go out and experience them. The fitting clubs will start shipping soon. September the 5th is when those should all be in hands at most of the key retailers. So that's just a couple weeks away. Read up on them, give them a good swing. And Dan, I'm curious, when are you going to embrace lofts getting stronger? You're not getting younger. I'm just going to say that.
It's funny, man. I went and we talked about this previously. I would bet that Forge would probably be where I would land in a 9.2 series. But every time I hit like 2.25 blew my mind, and then 2.45, by far my favorite club in the lineup. Like that thing is insane. And I admit I haven't spent much time with it this year, but it's been in my soul since the last time it was cold in Ohio, which was a long time ago. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not afraid of the idea of getting supportive lofts. What I always fear, and I love the candid conversation today, what I always fear is this is technology with my air quotes, and you need to play this, and pay a lot of money for it. So the chance for companies to prove themselves is, I think, one of the most important things, and there's no better place to do that than a hitting bay. And then go tell everyone on THP what you think about it, because the more feedback we get on there, the better chance golfers have of going and getting fit or trying things that might actually work for their game. And that's my end goal. So
Yeah.
cool.
I love it.
Hey man, I appreciate it. I'm blown away at the conversation today. That was super fun. I think people are really going to enjoy it. This is going live on THP, I think this Friday, and we'll have a conversation. Most definitely, you should check it out, because I'm sure people will have questions for what you've said today. But
I will.
You know that's happening. So those out there, definitely go check out 925, and if you haven't hit 923, check them out as well, because I mean they're a very cool line in themselves, and if not a precursor to go and experience 925 and see what's changed. But yeah, we'll have this conversation on THP probably this Friday if you want to come and chat about it. Either heckle or celebrate what's going on. And I can't wait to maybe possibly see what's happening down the line. I'm super
For sure.
excited about that line filling out. But you know me, dude. I think I'm 2.45 for life at this point. So,
Love it.
Chris,
Love
man,
it.
thank you, buddy. I hope you're doing well. And we'll probably chat with you soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Y'all have a great one. And looking forward to the Victory Cup. Let's go, Team Vauchel.
Oh, here we go. Shots fired. We'll call it shots fired. Talk to you guys soon. Well, if you guys are playing golf this week, have fun. Make it count. The days are dwindling. I'm afraid 2024 is getting scary. So either way, we'll see you guys next week.
THP Radio on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network, your number one source for all things golf. Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.